History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned over the years that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then be patient enough to listen as stories from long, long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. The man we have the privilege of meeting today has had more than a few adventures in his 92 years. 70 years ago, he was a medic in the Korean War. We caught up with him in Reedley, California, but we're going to let him introduce himself in the language he spoke extensively for 20 years as a missionary, Japanese.
私は Ivan D. Borugemus と申します。こちらは私の息子、テリーさんです。I introduced myself as Ivan D. Wolgamuth, and this is my son, Terry Wolgamuth.
So you probably did that a few times in 20 years on the mission field, huh?
Oh, yeah. 家内と私は娘もありいました。娘の名前はサンドラ・ジーン・ボルゲムスです。And I just said that we have a daughter by the name of Sandra, and her name is Sandra Borugemus. That's Wolgamuth.
It rolls off your tongue, but I'm sure it wouldn't have back in Hooker, Oklahoma, where you were born in 1931, and you're a child of the Dust Bowl. That's how your family ended up here in California. But I'm wondering what kind of early family memories you have from the 1930s.
I remember the dust storms we had in Oklahoma, and then I remember when our family decided to move to California like a bunch of Okies did at that time, and we had a 31 Chevy sedan pulling a four-wheel grain trailer with all our belongings in it. When we got to California, they asked if we had anything else yet, and my folks said no. And then they went to Shafter, California. They had friends there, and my folks picked up potatoes in Shafter to make a little money so we could go on to Orland, to where we lived there. And finally, we were able to buy a 10-acre place there close to the Sacramento River, and that was good. I went to an elementary school called McIntosh all 8 years, and sometimes we would go barefooted when we could, and finally my folks bought my brother and I a bicycle, and we would take turns pumping each other to school, and then our arrangements on Sunday was that one Sunday he would have the bike and the next Sunday I would have the bike. But we always went to church in the morning at Wednesday night prayer meeting, and in the evening we had church. Usually missionaries would come and give their reports there. So it was a good life. We did a lot of fishing and everything went well.
Do you remember at a young age having some thought in your head of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I want to do with my life?
I don't know if I did at that time, but I always admired the missionaries. They would come and give reports from India, from Africa, and other places of the world, and China. And I thought, how wonderful that is to bring the gospel to other people.
I guess I should also ask, too, since it was the Dust Bowl and, you know, the greater theme of the Great Depression that brought your family from Oklahoma out here to California. Do you have some memories of those Depression years that maybe kids today would be alarmed by or have it raise their eyebrows a little bit?
Well, when we came through New Mexico and Arizona, I remember the Indians trying to hold up different wares. They wanted us to buy them, and the hobos would ride on the trains, on top of the trains, and in the boxcars. There was a lot of that. going back and forth.
Yeah, not something we'd be used to today for sure. And, you know, what about also, I guess you're 10 years old when America is drawn into World War II. And a lot of the folks I speak with on this program were in World War II. You were too young for it. But I'm sure you have some memories of those war years and how things changed.
I remember we heard that Pearl Harbor was bombed, and so we intently listened to the radio. We had an old Philco radio that we could listen to, and then it wasn't long our area decided that they would have a plane watch, and I volunteered with my dad, did too, and my brother. And we would go to a certain place, and for 4 hours, we would listen for planes to come. Any plane that we heard, we could almost identify it, and then we'd call in and say, it's such and such a plane going somewhere. We were kind of fearful that the Japanese were coming into California, too.
And I'm sure at the time, you couldn't have imagined spending 20 years in Japan.
I guess that all started when I was 17, and I volunteered to take those goats, 250 goats with three other men, that we took care of the goats on a ship.
And I've got to stop you there for a second, because some people are saying, what in the world are you talking about? 17-year-olds volunteering to take 250 goats. How does that happen? What was the story here? How did you get roped into that?
Well, Sunday evening, we had a young people's meeting in the Dinuba MB Church, and we had a person come in there, and he told us about this goat program. And that evening, he said he was going to, we had a local small Japanese church, and he'd be there. Two other fellows, myself, went over there and volunteered, but the other two backed out, but I was determined. I wanted to go, and my folks were a little bit concerned with it, but in a way, we went to Modesto, where they gathered all the goats together, and then from there, we took them to San Francisco and loaded them on the ship. So that was quite a trip, too. That was my first introduction to Japan.
Yeah, and I would imagine just the journey over there had to be something, especially with all those goats.
Yeah, I know. Our job was to feed the goats and to water them, to clean the pens. And then when we got to Yokohama, well, they unloaded them, and they were used for milk and for hospitals and orphanages. And during that time is when I learned to know of this. One of our persons was Sim Togasaki, and he could speak Japanese well, and his parents were elderly Togasakis, had moved to San Francisco about just before the earthquake in 1903. We remained friends, too, for all these years with the Togasaki family.
And I suppose I should ask you that, too, because I know you moved from up north in Orland down to this Dinuba Reedley area and went to Emmanuel High School, and that was at the end of World War II and the years that followed. But this area during World War II, all the Japanese American families were forced out, sent to camps. When you came to this area, did you get a taste of what had happened? Did you have friends who were Japanese American? Did you have any inclination of any of that?
Yes, we had neighbors, Kay and Rosie Watanabe in Dinuba, and they had been to, they were taken to these camps. It was not an easy life, and we became close friends, so they would come to our place, and in a way we would eat together and so on. But I know of another Japanese family that were taken into the camp. Their name was Abe, and there was a Virgil Kleinsasser said that he would go and take care of their ranch for them. And I think he did it for nothing, you know, just wanted to develop friendship. So there was almost all the Japanese were taken into camps.
Yeah, and there was a tenor during that time of anti-Japanese fervor here in the States. Obviously, that's what led to that. And even after the war, I mean, I've met some veterans who they say it took them decades to even consider buying a Japanese car or anything like that. There was this hostility between America and Japan. And I ask that because you're going to Japan about 3 years after the surrender as an American teenager with 250 goats.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes and understand the perspective that you had.
I never did have an animosity against the Japanese. I felt more I wanted to help them. And that's why I volunteered to take those goats over there, because I knew that the goats would provide milk for the hospitals and orphanages over there. And they did this in Okinawa, too. Europe, they did cattle over there after the war.
And was there something that happened on that trip for you that kind of put a thought in your mind or lit a flame in you for Japan?
I don't know at that time. Maybe not. It was later on when I was in the Army in Korea, and I went on R&R to Japan twice. And at that time, I went once to Osaka area and stayed with the Sam Krauses, who were missionaries in Japan. He had also been in the Army and was on the island of Okinawa. Later on became a missionary, but at that time I got my first idea of mission work in Japan. Sam Krause took me to the camp area, what they had there, and the churches, and I don't know, I just felt maybe someday I would go there too.
Well, and you brought up the Army, and I want to hear about that. How did you end up in the Army as a medic during the Korean War?
I was in the Army for 2 years, but I got to Korea on New Year's Day, 1953. I landed at Busan, and we got off the ship. And when we got off the ship, they gave us what we called Mickey Mouse boots, thermal boots, and a big heavy overcoat, and then K rations. And we got on a rickety old Korean train and went north. We ended up at Yeongdong-po, and there they assigned us to our different units. Then I was assigned to this 123rd Medical Psychiatric Unit in a holding company. We were there for some time, and then we moved out, went to another camp a little closer towards the front lines. My buddy Irvin Taves was also from our church, and he went to Incheon to the Air Force Base there, and he was a baker. But on Sundays, he and I would try to meet with each other at the 51st Evac Hospital. Finally, I got enough other guys to go there, so they would furnish us what they called a weapons carrier, like a truck. So we'd try to meet there as often we could. They had a good chaplain there. We also had, once in a while, a chaplain would come to our unit, and we'd just have church in a tent, and these army benches that are just canvas and fold open. And the time I was in at night, I spent 14 months on cots, you know, just regular old cots with a mattress. And later on, I got a sleeping bag. It was so cold in winter. Our river close by, the Incheon River, would freeze over a meter thick. And then summer, it got so hot and humid, and we had to watch out for mosquitoes. And there were other buddies that I knew, too, had ended up over there. Just before I guess it was in 1953, about April, they had a wounded prisoner exchange up by Panmunjom. Of course, it was out in the rice fields. The army engineers had put down a metal bat so the helicopters could land, and ambulances come up and exchange prisoners, wounded prisoners. That was interesting to me. Later on, when we were missionaries in Japan, all of a sudden I got a letter saying that the Korean government was willing to give any veteran 1 week of hotels, food, and sightseeing if we could get over there. So I told my wife, we were in Japan already, let's just go. Didn't take long, and we landed there at Incheon Airport, and that's, we spent a week and were able to go up north to the place where we had been. And then we went up to the 38th parallel, where they've had those meetings with the North and the South. And our leader told us, now, you can walk around the table, don't make any gestures, but that way you'll have been in North Korea. And so That's what I can say today. I'm still to this day very happy that I could be in the service. I think about it almost every day. Not always easy, but it was rewarding.
Well, I've got a lot of questions about it. But the first one, an important one, did they draft you or did you volunteer to go in?
I was drafted. 1 year after we were married on February the 9th, 1951, and 1952 is when I was drafted. If you want me to, I can read a verse in Deuteronomy 24:5 where it says, a man should not go out to fight until a year after you're married. And so I don't know if the draft board do that verse or not, but anyway.
You mean you didn't send that verse to Uncle Sam?
No, I have it here, though.
Well, and there's a reason for that, right? That newlyweds should spend some time together. So how did your wife feel about that?
She moved in with her parents. And then when I was in Korea on August 31st, she gave birth to a daughter, Sandra. And I got a telegram in Korea that she had been born. We got together and had some refreshments with some of the other guys there and celebrated a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I've interviewed a fair share of veterans who didn't get to meet their firstborn child till they came home from war. And I've always tried to put myself in their shoes and there seems to be a couple sides of it. It seems a little bittersweet, right? I mean, you'd really like to be there, and isn't there an element, too, of, well, I better make it home now?
Yeah, and after I finally got home, I went to, we landed at Camp Stoneman here in California, and then we were, when I was out, I was looking for my folks and folks-in-law, and finally they saw me, and my wife came out with our daughter, Sandra, and I was so happy to see them both, you know, and so then from there we came back to Dinuba then.
Sure, everybody can feel what you're feeling as they listen to you. With regard to your time in the Army, though, so they draft you, they take you overseas away from your pregnant wife. What were your expectations of what you were going to do over there?
Well, I really didn't know, but I had gone to, I took my basic training at Camp Pickett in Blackstone, Virginia, and then I went to San Antonio, Texas, where they have their medical school. I signed up for x-ray technician, but the school was full, so they put me into this neuropsychiatric unit. And I had some other buddies there too, so we took training there, and then we did practical work in El Paso, Texas, at Beaumont General Hospital. Then from there I went home and for furlough for about a week, and then I flew to Seattle, Washington, where there was a little camp there, I guess you'd call it a repo depot, where the soldiers all came together, and finally they called our names, and 3,000 of us went and boarded a ship. The Marine Serpent was the name of the ship. As we got on board with a duffel bag and our handbag, the Gideons were there to give us each a testament. And we went on board and found our place. I was towards the end, since Wolgamuth with W, and it was towards the bow of the ship, which was a good thing. And we had hammocks about four or five high, and I took the second or third one. And they had already chosen all the guys to do the KP, and so I did have to do that. But then we went out on board again, out to the outside, and the Army chaplain prayed, and then the Army chorus sang, God be with you till we meet again. And I know that 3,000 of us went over there, but I don't know if how many came back, and I know some were killed there in the war, but I thank the Lord that I could come back.
Well, and that was a question I was going to ask you, especially in light of having to leave behind your new wife and then knowing that you were expecting a child. Was there any question in your mind? Did you ponder that thought maybe I'm not going to make it back to see this wife. Maybe I'll never meet this child that I don't know who that's going
to
be.
Yeah, you have to think that way because you never know. In our company, we had what we called 10 o'clock bed check Charlies come over, little Piper Cub type of planes, and they'd throw out incendiary bombs. And sometimes they would hit a oil dump and blow up everything. But we would run out to foxholes to take cover. And one time they dropped a bunch of propaganda sheets. And I still have some of those things. And I've kept most of my Army stuff. And in a way, I thank the Lord that I could go. And when I was drafted, I was drafted with another fellow, a friend, Delbert Reimer. And we were just one number apart. My number was US 56127753. And I forget whether his was one number more or one number less. But in a way, we were inducted finally at Fresno first and went to Fort Ord, which I don't think is there anymore. But there we got outfitted. And then from there, we got on a train and started heading for Virginia. And on our way at Wells, Nevada, our train got snowed in for 4 days. And we had sleeper cars, good facilities, and the food. And we could walk around outside until we had to leave again. And then we went on to Chicago and changed trains and went down to Virginia. And that's kind of that story.
I guess I should ask you, too. I don't know the answer to this. There are different denominations and faiths that in the war preferred to be conscientious objectors and not be part of the fighting. Was that the case with the Mennonite brethren that your family was a part of?
Yeah, there were some that went into doing hospital work and so on and so forth. But I went and talked to our pastor at that time, B.J. Brown, and he said he thought he would go into the Army. I was a 1AO, so I didn't have to carry a weapon, but I took the training along with everybody else.
So you didn't have to carry a weapon because of the pacifist nature of the Mennonite religion?
Yes, that's the way it was, but I did all the training that the other soldiers did, like, we had to all get into a trench and then go under barbed wire while they were shooting live ammunition, tracer bullets, you crawl out and you turn on your back and you wiggle under the barbed wire, keep your head down, and I did all of that. I went on all the marches. We did our compass work at night, and it was just part of everything except carrying weapons.
And how did you feel about that?
I think I felt okay. Sometimes I would feel sorry for guys carrying their weapons on marches. I'd carry it for them. And in Korea we had steel helmets, and we had those. We could turn them upside down, and they had a place to put into a wooden thing that was our wash basin and wash up there, and I was happy with that.
It's time for our first break, but there's more to come with 92-year-old Korean War veteran Ivan Wolgamuth of Reedley, California. More from his time in Korea as a medic in a neuropsychiatric unit, and also how his family ended up becoming missionaries to Japan. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.